Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Today is September 11th, 18 years ago. Today, the Twin Towers came down, a passenger plane was flown into the Pentagon, and another crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Today, hundreds of people, including families of 9/11 victims, survivors, politicians, and local leaders gathered on the 9/11 memorial site in New York, others commemorating the tragedy at the other sites and across the country. To mourn the losses from this horrific act is not enough. For as horrific as those deaths and injuries were and continue to be, it continues to be horrific because we're still engaged in what has become the longest war in American history. We're still fighting in Afghanistan, and the first responders, those who heard the call and responded to the call to save lives with no consideration of their own, have suffered grievously. Their cancers, their depression, and other illnesses have been ignored for too long. Financially debilitating medical debt from their illnesses have been ignored for too long. If it weren't for John Stewart and the pressure he applied, Congress would not have finally acted in the manner in which it has. For insight into more of this, we turn to my first guest. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University and the author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me again.
Thank you. Thank you. Is the premise of my opening accurate?
Yes, I was going to say that I think there's sort of two lingering questions that are out here that your premise opens up. One is to think 18 years later, we're still fighting a war in Afghanistan, and it's not clear what the end game is, what victory is, when are we going to leave? And that raises lots of questions in terms of, are we in an endless war? And then two, as you point out, that we had a lot of people who obviously lost their lives, but who also sacrificed their lives. And we seem to have not really provided well for those individuals over time, again, who suffered major injuries, physical and psychological and emotional. And you have to sort of ask in terms of both of those questions, again, what do we owe to these providers? And B, what's our end game? When do we declare we've won, we've lost, cut our losses and leave? I mean, these are really important questions.
Well, and to your point, we also now, find that Saturday there was a possibility that arrangement could have been reached between the Taliban and the United States, which would have resulted in, I'll just say, a decline in violence and allowing the United States to begin withdrawal of troops. And the president just blew that up because they couldn't figure out how to deal with the optics of an American soldier having been killed in Afghanistan after 775,000 troops fought in the war, and the numbers that I show, about 2,400 American service members have died, including 16 in combat this year, and 20,000 more have been wounded more grievously.
You're right. There's a lot of optics problems, deep and short. I mean, the short-term optical problem that he faced was that the story about doing the negotiations is coming out close to the anniversary of 9/11, inviting him to Camp David, where apparently the plans for the response to 9/11 were made, and also very shortly after, around the time when a bombing had occurred. So the short-term optics were not good. But the longer-term one, I'm almost going to call this kind of the Vietnam syndrome, because it reminds us of that. Let's take us back to the Vietnam era, where we lost, 50,000 American lives, hundreds of thousands were wounded. And at some point, it becomes hard to say, well, if we don't actually win or have a victory, whatever victory means, does that mean that all these lives have been lost in vain? And I think the same question the United States is facing right now is, again, at some point, you can't be in an endless war. You can't keep fighting. There's got to be some definition of when do you end hostilities or when do you declare victory or loss, whatever it is. But the incredible amount of human sacrifice, and I hate to say this, the money, the time, the leaders yet to have a credible answer to how to address those questions. And so that's a problem. But was Trump fundamentally correct initially in the idea, or is administration correct in terms of saying, we got to resolve this diplomatically at some point if we're not resolving it militarily? That's probably the right answer.
This is not a popular question, but I think it's a question that we have to come. Are we as Americans lying to ourselves? And what I mean by that is the terrorists attacked the United States on September 11th, and they extracted immeasurable amount of pain and suffering and carnage. But the job of a terrorist is to incite terror. And as a result of those acts, they've changed our culture forever. And so if the job of a terrorist is to incite terror, they won the game here.
Well, they did win the game in the sense that did it change, you're right, our culture? Did it change the law in terms of things like the Patriot Act? Has it immobilized us from having a serious debate about the aims and means for the war on terrorism?
Is the United States' response to this bankrupting this country and prohibiting us from investing resources into the things that we really need to invest resources into? I'd say absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, I've seen estimates, and I'm probably low at this point, about $1.5 trillion, I think, for Afghanistan. And maybe it's higher, you know. But
it depends on how you calculate the money, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I was going to say, so depending on there, I mean, what could we do alternately with $1.5 trillion to make America a strong country? We could rebuild infrastructure, healthcare, education. There's a lot of things we could do, but we are frozen in this path now. And then think about it. Even back when Obama was running for president and even when Trump was running for president, to broach the subject of saying that we're going to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, it immediately elicits significant backlash because people are saying, well, has everything all been done in vain? And are we just saying we've wasted all our money? And so we're not able to come to grips with asking what are realistically, some tough foreign policy. And maybe I will even say domestic policy or ethical questions that really need to be addressed.
And I think there's even a more fundamental question, and that is that was bantered about, are you saying we lost? Are you saying we've been defeated? America can't be defeated. Well, yeah, it can. And it has been.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't this Vietnam all over again? I mean,
And here's another thing. It was George Bush's reaction to this was an incredibly foolish blunder, because if Osama bin Laden was in fact the target that we were pursuing, Navy SEALs could have handled that business. Special Forces could have handled that business. We could have done this with a much smaller footprint, is my point.
Yeah, and what we're also getting at here too is, let's think back to when Jimmy Carter was president and there was the Iranian hostage crisis. And he initially tried to resolve this throughout the International Court of Justice and to go through, let us say, established international law, hugely criticized as being weak and ineffective. And the reason why I mention that is that there's a macho aspect to American politics. And I know someone strikes you, they kill you, over 3,000 people, your first instinct is to what? SWAT back, which is what we did. But would have the smarter instinct had have been perhaps, and let's play this out here. I know it's maybe not a popular answer. Maybe what you're talking about, the surgical strike for Osama bin Laden, maybe it would have been what? Pursuing international diplomatic channels, apprehending and putting Osama bin Laden, you know, on trial. I mean, there are a variety of other possibilities that maybe we could have considered that would have been more effective, less costly to human lives. But instead, we went for what's now turned out to be, like you said, 18 years, $1.5 trillion, however many human lives, plus what civilian lives, you know, over in Afghanistan. And that's where you ask the question, well, what have we accomplished? And so the military means, which is what we really opted for, which what George Bush went for, why it might have made us feel good, really short term. Yeah, we've taken Kabul, we've taken Afghanistan. We really have to ask in a larger perspective, was it really the smartest or successful strategy to pursue?
Because it also has become the precipitant to so many other issues around the world, because we're not only dealing with Afghanistan, we're dealing with Iraq, we're dealing with Yemen, we're dealing with Syria, we're dealing with Turkey, we're dealing with so many other issues that many of which were, again, fall out of this foolish rabbit hole that we've gone down. And again, we've turned our back on the first responders. How much of that $1.5 trillion or $1.2 trillion could have gone to help with the medical care for those first responders? How long was their cancer ignored and scoffed at? Oh, all they did was breathe some dust as they were, you know, going through the rubble. How many of those families went bankrupt before Congress recognized that, in fact, their illnesses were real, their illnesses were tied to September 11th, and the United States government needed to be affirmative in its response and in its support for the people who just did their jobs?
You're absolutely right. I was going to say, again, to do the Vietnam parallel, for the returning military veterans who came back from Vietnam, for how many years did we grapple with the fact that, you know, we had used Agent Orange over there and we weren't willing to recognize the injuries or recognize what? Post-traumatic stress syndrome and so forth like that. I think, again, it's sort of the same thing we're seeing here, is that the people who we ought to hold out as the heroes, we seem to have ignored them. And they've been lost, I think, in our discussions that, yes, today on 9/11, you know, we should be honoring those, you know, who were victims. But part of what I think really would be a broader testament to 9/11 would be also honoring and helping those responders. But also, I think, in a broader sense, asking the question, what's next after 18 years? You know, do we just keep saying that this is the endless war on terror? Are you and I going to do this show in 2030, you know, and say now we are 29 years out or something like that? You know, I mean, right now, we seem to be immobilized in terms of a society's ability, our society's ability to be able to move on and move forward to the discussion.
Professor David Schultz, thank you. That was a very good conclusion to the conversation. Greatly, greatly appreciate that perspective. You're the professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. Thank you again for your time today. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
You're welcome.
All right, folks. You're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Internment camps for the homeless? Really? Following reports that President Trump is pushing for a, quote, major crackdown, end quote, on homelessness in California that could include destroying existing encampments and moving homeless people into government-backed facilities, state lawmakers and progressive housing advocates said the administration's proposed steps are cruel, politically motivated, and would do nothing to address the very real crisis the president has exacerbated. The Washington Post reported yesterday that the president ordered White House officials to begin work on a sweeping effort to address the homelessness crisis in California. As part of the new initiative, Trump administration officials from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and Justice Department visited California this week for meetings and tours. what does this mean for homelessness across the country? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She is Diane Yentel. Diane, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hi, thank you.
So is this headline a provocative scare tactic, or is there real concern that the Trump administration is going to impose or engage in a major crackdown of homelessness in California and move people into government-backed facilities?
Well, there's concern for sure. I mean, we know that they are contemplating some big, potentially radical changes to how the federal government addresses homelessness. We don't know the details. We do know that there are considerations and conversations around further criminalization of homelessness, potentially increased arrests. There's conversations about potentially setting up some type of federal homeless camps in the state of California or even along the West Coast. So we really don't know the details, but certainly are concerned. And just to be, you know, very clear, the solution to homelessness is affordable homes, right? Not criminalization, not punishing poor people for their poverty, not sweeping homeless people into increasingly unsafe areas or warehousing people in, you know, untenable and unsustainable conditions, all of which it sounds like the White House is seriously considering.
And you're quoted in the article, Internment Camps for the Homeless, Housing Advocates Horrified by a Trump Push for Crackdown in California. You're quoted as saying, they've proposed drastically shrinking or eliminating federal programs that keep the lowest income people affordably housed, tripling rents for the lowest income subsidized residents, and raising rents for all others, evicting 100,000 people, including 55,000 American children, from subsidized housing, and allowing homeless shelters to discriminate and refuse shelter to transgender and other LGBTQ people.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, the homelessness issue in California is a crisis.
Yes,
it
is.
To be sure.
Yes,
it is. Just like it is across the country and communities across the country. And it's the kind of crisis that demands a sense of urgency, and it demands action from federal, state, and local governments. And it should be welcomed that the federal government and a presidential administration is taking note and paying attention and sending a team, a delegation, to look into issues and consider solutions. But this administration has a track record of worsening homelessness. You know, if they actually wanted to solve for the challenges of homelessness, they would start with protecting and expanding funding for the programs that end homelessness, proven solutions to ending homelessness. But instead, they've proposed cutting or even eliminating those very programs, and all of the other policy initiatives that you just mentioned are ones that this administration has prioritized. So it's impossible to take them at face value and assume that there's any goodwill here. It does look like this is simply President Trump really politicizing the problem of homelessness as a way to try to embarrass and punish people that he perceives as his political opponents, mayors and governors of California and other states, and to cast blame on local officials so that he doesn't have to accept any of the federal government's responsibility in creating and exacerbating, in his case, the housing crisis.
Now, this article was focused on California, and I am from Sacramento, California, and spend a lot of time in Oakland, spend a lot of time in San Francisco, and a lot of time in Los Angeles. And to your earlier point, the housing crisis is, the homelessness is horrific. You can't find an open patch of grass, for example, in Oakland, or go under a freeway overpass and not find people living in tents or living in their cars. What people have to get beyond this stereotype of lazy, shiftless people that just don't want to work. You have college professors, people teaching at California State universities that are living in their cars. You have people with PhDs living in their cars. And so if this economy is doing as well as the president claims the economy is doing, the booming economy is not trickling down to improving the standard of living for working and middle class Americans.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. You're absolutely right that homelessness is increasing in many of the city, in all of the cities that you just mentioned, sometimes dramatically increasing. And you're absolutely right that many of the people who are experiencing homelessness or who are right on the cusp, they are seniors or they're people with disabilities who are on really limited fixed incomes, you know, very small amounts of money to try to make ends meet throughout the year as rents skyrocket. Or they're working. Just like you said, there are folks who are living in their cars and their RVs with their families, and they're sleeping at night in their car, and in the morning they're going to the local Y, taking a shower, and then getting to work. And the economy, as you said, it's working very well for very wealthy people. And in fact, it's getting better. But for low-wage workers, it's getting worse. And the jobs that our economy are creating are predominantly low-wage jobs. In fact, the Department of Labor puts out projections for the type of jobs that are likely to have the greatest growth over the next 10 years, and 7 out of 10 of those jobs pay less than what it costs to rent a modest one-bedroom apartment. So you're right. People are working. They're working hard. Sometimes they're working multiple jobs. But rents are
just
so high
poor.
And wages are so low that they can't afford the rent. So they're either paying ridiculous amounts of their income towards their rent, 60, 70, 80% of what they make each month goes to keep a roof over their head, or they're actually experiencing homelessness and they're sleeping in shelters or on the streets. The other thing I think that's important for people to understand is that the homelessness crisis in L.A. and Oakland and San Francisco, it's severe. As I said earlier, it requires real attention and urgency and action. But homelessness exists in communities throughout the country, from rural, suburban to urban, and other cities. Like, it may surprise people to know, it often does, that New York City actually has more people experiencing homelessness than the city of L.A. But the difference is that in New York City, about 95% of people who are homeless, they're in shelters. But in L.A., about 75% of people who are homeless don't have access to shelter. So they have no choice but to sleep in their cars, in RVs, or on the street.
And it's not as though, particularly when you look at homelessness in urban centers, it's not as though we don't have the housing stock. In too many instances, developers are being given access to that housing stock to support gentrification or contribute to gentrification in our urban centers instead of the government stepping in and creating affordable housing for people. And then when you have a secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development who knows nothing about housing and urban development, that also causes us or exacerbates the systemic problem that contributes to all of this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and there's a few different things going on that are creating the really severe housing crisis that exists in California today. And part of it is that there's simply not enough apartments actually being built to keep up with the demand. So the demand is skyrocketing. Supply has really been constricted, and it's constricted because of a lot of local zoning laws that don't allow for the development of any kind of apartment, much less affordable apartments. I mean, in the city of Berkeley, it's practically illegal to build an apartment, and that's true for other cities in California as well, and other cities in the country. And so what happens is when you restrict supply so much and demand is going up, the rents skyrocket. So that's part of the challenge, is that local communities really need to look at removing those restrictive zoning laws and allow for apartments to be built. That's going to bring down costs for middle-class people a little bit. They're going to start to feel some relief. But for the lowest-income people, for people who have such limited incomes, the private market can't build homes, can't build and operate homes that are affordable to them. And that's where government subsidies are necessary. But government subsidies have declined dramatically over the last few decades. And as a result, we've seen homelessness dramatically increase over that same 3-4 decades.
And I think it's important, as we got to get out here, I'm glad you talked about over the last 3 or 4 decades, because this is not just a Trump administration problem. This is a systemic problem that really has been going on in America since the Reagan administration.
That's exactly right. And it hasn't been going on forever, which is another thing that I think is so important for people to know. If we went back to like the late 1970s, we'd find a time when we actually had more, there was actually a surplus of homes affordable to the lowest income people. Today, there's a shortage of 7 million homes affordable to those same lowest income people. Back in those late 1970s, we didn't have the kind of homelessness that
right.
exists today. You didn't have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people sleeping on the streets or in shelters. And the main difference between then and now was federal spending on programs that keep the lowest income people housed. The cuts and the decline started with Ronald Reagan, and there's been a trend that's kept up ever since.
I got to get out. Diane Yentel, President and CEO, National Low Income Housing Coalition. Thank you so much for your time. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, there's democracy for some, but not for all. A report reveals that nearly 1,700 polling places have closed since the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act. Civil rights advocates said yesterday that the U.S. Supreme Court must restore a key provision of the Voting Rights Act after a sweeping new report showed how the court's decision led to the closure of nearly 1,700 polling places across the American South. The Leadership Conference Education Fund study entitled Democracy Diverted revealed yesterday that nearly 1,200 of the polling places were closed between the 2014 and 2018 midterm elections, underscoring the scale of this assault on U.S. democracy, according to the report. How serious of a problem is this? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. She's communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
1,700 polling places closing, making it harder for people to vote instead of making it easier for people to exercise the franchise. Your thoughts?
It's American history. It never changes. This has been the story since the 13th Amendment, when black men were allowed to vote, where throughout our history, black people have been killed and intimidated from going to vote. We've had a Supreme Court, not just this one, that supported the ability to take someone's right to vote away. And it is appalling, absolutely appalling. It's frightening to watch this administration and this Supreme Court roll back the 20th century.
And to that point, why aren't there more voices crying about this atrocity? I with the report coming out yesterday, I would have thought Democratic leaders would be coming to the forefront. I would have thought that we would have seen this on some of the evening news programs, whether it's MSNBC or CNN. This just basically just fell by the wayside.
Because corporate media decides which 5 stories they're going to cover, and they cover them over and over and over again. It's, you know, they just decide, you know, the Mueller report, or they decide it's this. And maybe they'll give them a break if it's 8 stories, and they do them over and over again. The reason they can get away with that is that black people, Latino people, have not come together as a political force. As we read in the report, in Arizona, most of the polling places that were closed were in Arizona, where so many Latino, Spanish-speaking people reside and will be horribly affected. I don't think that we contribute enough money to political campaigns so they could feel the force of our economic force. We even see ourselves as poor people when we're not. We are an economic force in this country. If we stop spending money, Black people, Latino people, if we stop spending money, the economy would collapse. So we have to see ourselves as empowered, not just wait for CNN or MSNBC to tell us that. Our leaders have to come together, you and I, and make every person a leader, have to come together and say, we are a force to be reckoned with, and you better be scared. And we haven't done that.
You know, the common narrative that continues to get repeated is, as you look at the result of the 2016 election, Black people didn't turn out. Black people didn't turn out. If only Black people had turned out, we would not have had the result that we have now. But there is more and more and more data, whether it's the data from Greg Palast or whether it's the data from the Leadership Conference Education Fund, that shows that there are systemic barriers that continue to be put in place since the 2013 ruling in Shelby County versus Holder, where the Supreme Court invalidated Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
Right, exactly. And that is where I think it's appalling. It's not just our turning out. It is our government, our democracy, supporting the fact that we should have polling places within a certain distance of people. We don't need the gerrymandering. But, you know, I would tell you the bigger question is, why do Black people need a Voting Rights Act? Doesn't the Constitution support us and uphold us the way it should? The 13th Amendment ended slavery. The 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. I don't understand why we continue to have to be second-class citizens, because we need special laws to make us American.
Well, because you can't legislate people's hearts and minds. You can put things on paper. You can make things law. You can make things constitutional. But first of all, in a number of the elements, particularly the 13th Amendment, abolished slavery, except what? In response to those who have been duly convicted of crime. So then that element gets used on the voting rights side to see to it that in many states, those who are convicted of felonies are not allowed to vote.
Which is absolutely ridiculous, because if the courts say your time is 10 years, at 10 years and one day, you should come back to being a citizen.
To be a full citizen. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Let me give just a couple of examples here. You mentioned Texas. Texas alone closed 750 locations in 13 out of 15 counties in Arizona, a state where 30% of the population is Latinx, shuttered polling places. Maricopa County, where 31% of residents are Latinx, closed more locations than any of the 758 counties.
If 700 polling places have been closed in Orange County, California,
right,
Montgomery County, Maryland, up and down Park Avenue in New York, there would be an outcry so loud it would shake the ground.
Absolutely right. And what I've been saying for about the last probably 3 or 4 years is that Texas and Arizona would be the next two states to turn purple. Arizona first and Texas second, based upon the increase of Latinx voters in those states, and that it would take Texas a lot longer, but the increase in Latino voters would force Republicans to spend more money and more time to keep Texas red.
Absolutely.
And in response to that, we see they're closing polling places in Texas, in Arizona, in Georgia.
But, you know, I'm grateful to you for bringing this up on your show, because a lot of people who didn't hear it in the corporate media, in the corporate American media, will now hear it on your program. And I really urge them to go to their elected officials and to go to their churches, fraternities, sororities, whoever is where they want to seek or they go to for their political power, and bring this up. And bring this up and start to write letters to the editors, the newspapers, and call producers and news directors at these big networks and complain that they're not being covered. This is a big story, and this is the strength of our democracy. It's the absolute biggest story there is.
there are two kind of related stories. One is the North Carolina election. Dan Bishop, Republican senator, he scored a very, very narrow victory yesterday, a Republican state senator. He scored a very narrow victory in a special House election in North Carolina. President Trump and Vice President Pence went down there to campaign for him. Now the president is saying that this reflects the power of Donald Trump and that Dan Bishop's victory is owed to the president. But others are providing the analysis that this was a Republican seat that they narrowly won and that this does not show the power that the Republicans are claiming that it does. Your thoughts?
My thoughts, I would be on the second set of opinions, because it doesn't show the power of the president. He narrowly won. If the president had actually been and Mike Pence, they sent both guns down there. If they actually had some influence, this could have been a landslide. You know, but the latest Washington Post ABC News poll shows that Donald Trump loses to Joe Biden by 15 points. He loses to Bernie. If the election was held today, he would lose to Bernie Sanders by 9 points, Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris by 7, and even Pete Buttigieg would beat him by 4 points. That is not good news for the Trump people. That is excellent news for the Democrats. And even though this seat was lost, this seat was lost narrowly, which means that it's sort of like in that movie Terminator, if it bleeds, it can die. The Trump support is bleeding, and that people, even his supporters, though they may yell and scream and cheer at rallies, either aren't turning out to vote, or the Democrats really are turning out to vote. And who knows what happens 15 months from now? Well, you know, the election is a year, 15 months away. But right now, if you look at the polls, I would never thought a year ago would you think that Bernie Sanders would actually beat Donald Trump. This is good news for the Democrats.
It is good news for the Democrats, but we also have to remember that the polling data, as we saw in the 2016 election, the polling data, and to your point, we're more than a year away from the election, and you can't put your faith in the polling data because
they told us that Donald Trump was unelectable. The polls did.
Exactly.
Three years ago. So I'm holding on to any sort of intellectual fact I can put my hand on that says that this man is beatable.
There's no question that he's beatable. The question is, can the Democrats formulate a narrative? Can they get beyond their own internal strife? And can they formulate a narrative, a mess? And you, as a communications expert, can definitely speak to this. Can they formulate a narrative and can they stay on message to convince the electorate? And can they put forth any tangible substantive policy that will show the electorate that their course is a better course?
I don't know. Can Barack Obama run again?
Well, now, that's interesting because, you know, the data showing he's not as popular now as he, you know, history is now showing a different, shining a different light on that administration. And even he is not as popular now as he was then.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
I think he's been disappeared. I think he disappeared.
Okay.
I think he disappeared, and I think the only narrative been written by people who oppose him a lot more. People are complaining about his administration, but I bet you if he got back out on the stump, he would be able to focus his message. He would be able to deliver it cleanly, and I think he'd be able to convince people he was right. In like 2008, even black people thought he could not be elected, and this man got and ran at absolutely efficient campaign.
I don't doubt that.
Capable of doing that again. I think he's capable of doing that again.
But listen to what I said though. I didn't say that. What I said was the data is showing, and history is now, the reflection of history is now showing that he is not as popular now as he was then. And the data supports that.
The same polls we don't believe.
No, no, no. Look, tell you what, Joy, you and I will have this. That's a conversation we'll have for another show.
But answer the question you want. I do think the Democrats will be able to do it. I think they have to weed out the people who are just trying to increase their speaking fees and the people who can seriously make this happen. And again, we'll know that by March, by the first batch of primaries. We'll know.
Joya Jefferson Nuri, communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, as always. Thank you for your time and your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. House Judiciary Committee approves red flag bill and high-capacity magazine ban. The House Judiciary Committee voted yesterday to approve gun violence prevention legislation as Congress faces pressure to take action in the wake of recent mass shootings. The Democratic-controlled committee approved several bills, including a measure to ban high-capacity magazines and a red flag bill during a markup where the committee convened to debate and vote on a series of gun control measures. The bill would still need to be voted on by the full House to advance, and the GOP-controlled Senate has not said what, if any, gun control legislation it would take up. Are these steps in the right direction? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a pastor of Peace Fellowship Church and organizer of Peace Walks DC, Reverend Delonte Golston. Reverend Golston, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leon. I appreciate you having me.
So your thoughts, you're very active in the community, particularly as it relates to gun violence in D.C. Your thoughts on where Congress is right now with these actions?
Well, I certainly want to commend Leader Pelosi and Judiciary Committee Chair Cummings for taking the step in the right direction around passing red flag law legislation and a ban on high magazine assault weapons. I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. And I think what I see happening is that essentially the House is calling the Senate's bluff and the president's as well. I know that we all know that within the first hours after the shootings in El Paso and in Dayton, Ohio, the commander-in-chief of the United States said that he would support so-called red flag laws that look into serious mental health issues relating to access to gun ownership. And of course, he walked that back. So there's been an effort of faith-based leaders and pastors across the country who have been pressuring Senator McConnell, and I've been a part of some of those efforts to contact and make appeals to senators from neighboring states like Tennessee and North Carolina and Colorado and others to kind of put pressure on Leader McConnell's office to actually make serious change when it comes to this issue. So I think it's a step that's in the right direction. And I think that it's high time that the Senate actually make a move on this issue, and that the president, who claims to be independent of the NRA and claims not to be in the pockets of the NRA, actually shows some a bit of a backbone, a bit of spine when it comes to this issue, as we are living in constant terror and fear of when we're going to have the next shooting.
To your point, congressional Democrats have called on Senate Majority Leader McConnell to hold a vote on expanded background check legislation that previously passed the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, has said that he does not intend to put any gun legislation on the Senate floor unless the president says that he'll sign it into law. And that, to me, really sounds a lot like either passing the buck or the left hand blaming the right hand and the right hand blaming the left hand, because McConnell's saying, well, if the president doesn't sign it, we're not going to put it on his desk. And the president is saying, well, give me something to sign. So they really seem to be passing the buck here, because really, Mitch McConnell has the ability to put legislation on the president's desk and create an environment in which the president would be forced to sign it. Mitch McConnell is that powerful, I believe.
Well, we see from the Senate Majority Leader is a lack of leadership. And what we see, I think, is this is just politics as usual in the Congress. And I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that we're looking at an extremely competitive Senate race in a number of key seats. And the last thing that McConnell wants is for his Republican colleagues to have a vote on record that the NRA will not endorse, because they realize that the math is very clear, particularly in the Republican base in rural areas and even in suburban areas, that there's still very strong support, particularly in rural areas, for against anything that would look like an infringement on the Second Amendment. I think that there is some give on this issue in more suburban areas. And I think that a lot of the data that we're seeing nationally is showing that increasing numbers of people, particularly in suburban areas, which are more and more likely to experience these kinds of shootings, are beginning to the needle is beginning to, you know, to change on this issue. And people are beginning to come around and see that simple common sense background checks, a simple common sense approach to this issue, is not about taking anybody's guns away. You know, it's really about making sure that we are safe. I mean, we're at the point now where we're having active shooter drills in schools. My church office is located in a school. We're having active shooter drills in schools at the rate that students in the 40s and 50s were having bomb drills, ducking under desks.
That was also in the 60s, because I was one of those students.
In the 60s. All right. That's for my time. Yes, indeed. So that's, you know, that's where we are. I think it really is a lack of leadership. And I would also say that this is also one of those issues that raises the specter or the power of race as well, because a lot of the times the gun violence that is perpetuated in urban areas is so often ignored. And so not only is Senator McConnell unwilling to lead the charge to keep suburban white families safe, but he's also not leading the charge to keep our black and brown loved ones safe in cities like D.C., Oakland, Baltimore, and the like across the country, Chicago, and the like across the country.
I got to stop you there. And to your point, the mantra that is used in cities like Chicago is black on black crime. But, you know, nobody talked about the shooting in Pennsylvania at the synagogue as white on white crime. And it's very easy to dismiss the tragedy when it's just, oh, black on black crime, because we know the stereotypes that get associated with language such as that. Reverend Delonte Golston, pastor of Peace of Fellowship Church and organizer of Peace Walks DC, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, there is outrage as the president smears Hurricane Dorian victims fleeing the Bahamas as gang members. The survivors of Hurricane Dorian are climate change refugees fleeing disaster, and they deserve compassion and support, not isolation and exclusion. Well, how is this impacting perception of what's going on and relief being provided to those victims? For insight, we turn to my next guest. She's an activist with the youth-led environmental organization Sunrise Movement. She is Zena Precht Rodriguez. Thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to us, the president's comments sparked outrage with your organization, the Sunrise Movement, with the Sierra Club and others. Talk about what he said and the impact that the president is having.
Right. So all of the language we're hearing around the influx of climate refugees from the Bahamas is nothing that we hadn't heard before from Trump. He called people from the Bahamas possible gang members and people who could be dangerous to the security of the United States. And so we are just remembering when he first launched his campaign and he said that people coming from over the border of Mexico could also be gang members and people who were dangerous, carrying drugs and being rapists. So while we're not surprised, it's still an outrage that when it comes to issues of life or death, where 70,000 people have been left without homes and over 50 dead in the Bahamas are seeking refuge, that they're faced with comments like this that actually have impacts on their ability to enter the U.S., whether that just be for a short time for relief.
He said, we have to be very careful. Very, very bad people could be attempting to enter the U.S. after Dorian devastated the Bahamas. And as I understand it, there's really no data, there's really no evidence to support that statement.
Yeah, absolutely no evidence. It's a tactic. It's a political tactic. He's inspiring fear in people and just essentially extending his rhetoric, anti-immigration rhetoric that he has been for the duration of his presidency and during his campaign, because he knows it riles people up and causes like division.
And as a result of that, refugees who were boarding a cruise ship to come to the United States as a result of the hurricane, they were taken off of the ship.
Yeah. So this has actual impacts on people who are fleeing the Bahamas because they don't have access to basic resources like water, food, homes, livelihoods. And they were promised initially by the United States that so long as they had the proper documents, which I think were initially a passport and a slip that indicated their if they had a criminal record or not, that they would be welcomed into the U.S. with open arms. And I mean, even expecting for people who just experienced a devastating hurricane as much as Dorian to have those documents is a high bar. But even those people who did have those documents and boarded one of the ships heading to the U.S., they were then denied entry and they actually had to turn around and head back to the place that they had just fled.
And here's the issue. The issue is, as I understand it, whether or not those individuals actually needed a visa to enter the United States. And based on a bilateral agreement, in certain circumstances, Bahamians and citizens of the Turks and Caicos don't need a visa. And I would think, as a result of the largest or the strongest hurricane to make landfall in recorded history, a Category 5 that spent 50 hours over dumping rain and 200-mile-an-hour winds on Abaco Island in the Bahamas, I think that could be considered a certain circumstance.
Absolutely. And I mean, the devastating circumstances are in this one moment of this one hurricane are definitely to be acknowledged. But the scarier part is that they're only going to get worse. And this is only the beginning of what seems to be our policy on climate immigration, on climate refuge. So this particular circumstance is extremely troubling. But taking this and looking into the future, it really raises questions about how, as a country, we are going to start to address migration that's happening from climate change. And I mean, we've even seen it with all the migration going on from Central America. So many people are fleeing that area because of the drought, because they don't have livelihoods because of climate change anymore. And so this is only an indication, I guess, of like what is a bleak future under the Trump administration. And I think it's also an important topic that the presidential candidates in the Democratic primary should be paying attention to as well.
As we get out here, because again, these people are climate refugees, and this problem is only going to grow worse as more of these storms continue to form, and there are going to be a lot more people all around the world that are being displaced and that are seeking safe haven from climate issues. Zena Precht Rodriguez, activist with the youth-led environmental organization, the Sunrise Movement. Thank you so much for your time and for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too. Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.